Okay, I met Jir, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to present my recent work with Timothy and Eugene at PI. So unfortunately, this work is just finished several days ago, so we don't have a paper right now, but hopefully we can post a paper very soon. Okay, so the motivation of this work comes from two pieces. The first one is more experimental. So in experiments, we always try to realize some Hamiltonians. And so it is important to just verify that the system that the experiments did is actually our desired Hamiltonian. So this is a problem of tomography. But standard quantum state tomography and quantum process tomography is exponentially expensive. So here, the exponentially expensive means that exponential in system size. So to my knowledge, that currently they can only do quantum process tomography for several qubits. And the second motivation is more theoretical. So from kinematic theory, we know that the many body states actually knows a lot of things about the Hamiltonian. For example, if we take the ground state of a many body Hamiltonian, then whether the quadratic decays or not decay, or decays exponentially or polynomially, roughly correspond to whether the Hamiltonian is gapped or not gapped. The other example is called the eigenstate summarization hypothesis, or ETH. So it tells you that for excited eigenstate, it locally looks like a thermal state. So hopefully you can extract a lot of information from the thermal, from a single eigenstate. Another piece of example is the topological internal entropy. So we know that we have a formula for topological internal entropy, which is equal to the logarithm of square root of some over like dimension square, right? So it knows something about the common dimension, which is essentially a property of the excitations. So 2 years ago, Xiaoliang Qi and Renner proved a pretty interesting result that generic Hamiltonian, which is many-body Hamiltonian and with local interactions, can actually be uniquely determined by any of its eigenstate. So I will talk about what is generic later, but before that, I will just give a comment. So this result is pretty astonishing, right? Because it tells you that any eigenstate actually knows everything about the Hamiltonian. So with this in mind, our question is, is it possible to simplify the tomography process for many body states? Okay, so and in this talk, I will talk about two results. The first one is more conceptually interesting, but it's not so practical. And the second one is very practical. So here is the first one. So the problem setting about the first one is as follows. Given an initial state plus at zero, and given a Hamiltonian, we know how to write down the final state as at time t. It's just you apply on the unit operator on the initial state. And our problem is the inverse problem. So is that possible to determine h just from the knowledge of psi zero and psi t? Well, with just a little bit of thinking, you will say it's not possible. Because like, for example, if the Hilbert space has dimension d, then this equation is just roughly only d equations. But to determine the Hamiltonian H, you need a metric which has d square parameters. So it's definitely not possible in general. However, this is why the many-body system is interesting. So for many-body systems, the Hamiltonian is often made of some local integral terms. For example, in the transverse Ising model, we have only ZZ interaction and X interaction. So for a spin chain with length L, we have only two L terms instead of L square terms. Also like Heisenberg model, we have three L terms. And aspect model, we have this four psi interaction, which roughly have L to the four terms. So the lesson is for many ball systems, we have polynomial many terms in the system size instead of this exponential many terms.
A couple of questions.
Okay.
First, it looks like you have infinitely many equations there for infinite.
Oh no, it's just for fixed t, just for one t.
For one t?
Yeah, for one t.
And what restriction or assumptions do you have on the initial state? The eigenstate of the Hamiltonian.
Right. And I will talk about it later. Okay. Since this polynomial is far less than exponential, so this simple counting doesn't work, so it might still be possible. And we will show that it's generically possible. Okay, so formally speaking, we are going to solve this problem. Assuming the Hamiltonian H is a summation of omega ii, so here the omega I is some coupling constants, and Li is are some local operators, for example, poly operators. And the terms are polynomial many, so n equals poly of L. We are going to try to solve this omega I from this equation. So and this problem is difficult because this equation for omega I is nonlinear, and not only nonlinear, but it's transcendental because omega I just happened in the exponential term. So the idea is that we want to extract some polynomial equations out of these transcendental equations. So because we have more control of polynomial equations. Okay, and the way we do this is it's just to use the energy conservation. So from this equation, you know that for any integer k, this equation is always true. And for example, if you take k equals 1 and you plug in those h equals to sum over omega ii, then you get this formula, like this equation, which is just a linear equation for the omega I. And for k equals 2, we got some quadratic equation of omega I. And in general, like for arbitrary k, you got this homogeneous polynomial equation for this omega I's. And the degree is k. Now let's do a naive number counting. So the number of unknowns here is n, because we have n omega i's, but they are homogeneous equations, so there are only n minus one independent unknown variables. And the number of equations, because for any k we have equation, but we can show that there are only up to d minus one equations. So if, for example, if d is bigger than n, then we can just pick up the first n equations, and hopefully they are good enough, they are generic enough to determine this omega uniquely up to a scalar. The reason that we pick n equations instead of n minus one equations is because for polynomial equations, for n minus one unknown variables, if we just pick n minus one equations, then the solution will be discrete but not unique. Here, it will be n minus one factorial choices. That's why we want to add one more equation, so that we hope that this solution can be solved uniquely. After we determine this omega up to a scalar, we can also determine the scalar generically, because generally we don't have an exact recurrence. Okay, and now before I give a schedule proof, I will talk about why when we fail. The first example is, as you said, if it is eigenstate, then the psi 0 is just psi t, and here the m is just 0. So we have no equation at all, definitely not unique. The other one is, if there exists a local operator, operator O, which is also a sum of local operator Li's, then and if this O is commute with H, then we have at least two solutions. The first one is H, and the second one is O. So in this case, it's not unique. This will happen, for example, if the system is classical. In this case, any term just commutes with each other. So we have a lot of O here. Similarly, for some MBL models, for example, it has been argued that the MBL Hamiltonian can be written in some localized bit, which it looks like a classical Hamiltonian. And if this localized bit has no tail at all, then it would just be classical. So in this case, it just this algorithm will fail. And similarly for some fine-tuned integral case. But as a corollary of our result, our first result, those counterexamples are just not generic. Okay. And the second comment is that even if we can recover the Hamiltonian from just a single pair of initial and final, this method is not practical. This is for the following reasons. The first reason is that the number of coefficients in this polynomial systems is exponentially many. And for each coefficient, you have to do several experiments to measure the coefficients. So you have to do many, many measurements, which is just impossible. And secondly, even if we have this equation on hand, it's actually an NP-completed problem to solve a generic polynomial equations. What if we want to solve it by some numerical methods? Well, because this equation just have so many coefficients, so even numerical method will be expensive. So that's why it's not practical. But nevertheless, it's very interesting. So I will sketch a proof. As the first warm up, let's review some simple facts of linear algebra. Assuming that we have n equations for n linear equations for n homogeneous unknowns, ax equals zero. So here a is like n by a matrix, x is a n by one vector. We want to solve x. Now generically, if for general a, there's just no solution, no non-zero solution. And if we want a to have at least one non-zero solution, the condition is that the determinant of a should be zero. And if we want it to have two solutions, or at least two solutions, equivalently, we require this rank of a to be less than or equal to n minus two. Or equivalently, all the n minus one minors have determinant zero. Okay, so the lesson is that whether it can, this generic, whether this equation has no solution or has one solution or two solutions can be equivalently represented by some polynomial conditions on the coefficients, because the determinants are some polynomials of the elements in A. And this is similar, this is something happened in the polynomial case. So assuming we have n polynomial equations for n homogeneous unknown variables, like this form for k goes to 1 to the n. Then generically, for generic m, it also has no solution, no non-zero solution. And in order for it to have at least one solution, equivalently, there should be some polynomial relation on this coefficients m to be zero. And for those of you who are interested, this polynomial is called Mercalli resultant. And similarly, for it to have at least two solutions, there should be some other set of polynomials. I call it poly two. So the poly two m should be zero. And it's important that this is an equivalent condition. Okay, now let's go back to our case. So in our case, we know that one solution just exists automatically because we are going to solve the true Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the solution. So in this case, the poly one is just zero automatically. And we want it to be unique. So we want the poly two to be non-zero for some kind of, for at least one poly two. And here is a key observation. So since each element of M is a real analytic function of omega, and since poly two is a polynomial, so this poly two M is a real analytic function of omega. And it's a mathematical result that tells us that if a real analytic function is non-zero at just one point, then it must be non-zero almost everywhere. So in order to prove the poly two is non-zero almost everywhere, we only need to check at one point. Like one point is enough to tell you almost everywhere. And so roughly we have proved the following theorem. Fix the system and fix the basis Li for local operators. Then if just one Hamiltonian can be uniquely determined from the Bob procedure, then almost all Hamiltonian can be determined in that way. Here's our checks for that one point. So we have to, we did three checks. The first one is analytical. So we use a transitional invariant transfer IC model, which are the first two terms. But if we only have first two terms, it's not interesting because we only have two unknowns here. And actually the first equation will be enough to determine the relative weight of lambda one and lambda two. So we add another term here, which is the next to nearest neighbor intersection, like YIY. And for this one, we can analytically show that the bulk procedure actually can solve those lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 uniquely. And the second check is numerical. We do a spin chain for some IC model with some fails, X and Z, and also for Hessian model. For these two models, on a finite spin chain, we can also numerically show that the answer is unique. Another one is more random. We do this random transverse IC model with random coupling. So here, the lambda I and HI are just random. But unfortunately, due to the computational the limited computational power, we can only do 7 local operators. Because you have seen that the polynomial system is exponentially large with a pretty large coefficient. So I think beyond 10 is not possible. So and we do 7. And in this case, it's also unique. I think that's it for the first part. Any question? Okay, then we'll go to the second part. So as I said, the first method is not practical because it's too complex, both experimentally and numerically. So we propose a more practical method, which is as follows. So we only use the linear equation, which is for the k equals 1. But to do this, we need to add another n minus 2 pairs of integral and final states. So totally n minus 1 pairs of integral and final states. And at the end, we have this kind of linear system. So the m here is a metric of n minus 1 by n, and x is n minus 1, is n by 1. So we just need to solve the kernel of this of this metric m to determine the Hamiltonian.
So by n minus 1 pairs, do you mean like n time slots or like 2 n time?
You prepare integral state, and after some time t, you got the final state, and you do another pair, you do another integral state and final state, and n minus one pairs. Yeah. Oh, actually, you can also do like for one evolution, but you do a n minus one cuts, so it will also give you n minus one pairs. And the similar arguments using analytic function still go through. So you only need to check at one point, and here's our check. Numerically, we do a spin chain with 8 spins with random one body and two body operators. So the total number of operators is 87 here. So we have like a 86 times 87 metric, and we solve it. We find that it's actually unique. So it is pretty practical because in general, if you only have n operators, then the size of m is roughly n square. So you only need to do roughly order n square measurements to determine this matrix m, and then you solve the kernel. So it's much, much better than the previous exponential method. However, like to make it practically useful, we have to consider the errors because all measurements just will come with error. And if you plug in those imperfect m with errors to that equation and solve the kernel, the answer will be very unstable. To resolve this trouble, let's take a closer look at what's going on. Okay, so formally, what we are doing is that we are given this equation for each I, for each measurement, then we measure this coefficient mij, but with errors, and we try to make some best guess of the omega I here. With just a little bit thinking, you will identify it with a linear regression question. So in the ordinary linear regression, you have y equals to sigma ki xi plus b, and you measure xi and y, and you want to find the best fit of this k and b. And here it is similar, right? Because this mi just correspond to the x and y. And this omega I is a k and b that you want to determine. So it's a linear regression question. The only difference is that it's a homogeneous variant. But nevertheless, we can still use the standard procedure, which is the least square method, to minimize this error square, the summation of error square. But here we have to impose another condition, which I use sigma omega I square equals one, because if there's no constraint, because this is homogeneous, then the best fit will be omega I equals zero. This is not what we want. Okay, now to solve this problem is a very simple exercise in calculus, and the answer is that the omega I is equal to the eigenvector of this m dagger m with minimal eigenvalue, or equivalently, the singular vector of m with a minimal singular value. Okay, so as a short summary, here's the procedure we propose to use with error. So first, for initial state, psi zero, we just evolve it with some time t, and then prepare and then measure those mij. And then we repeat for k different initials for k bigger than n minus one. And then we write down this k minus k by one metric and find its singular vector associated with the minimal singular value.
So initial state or
in
the second line?
Yeah, we do k different initial state. And so like k different pairs of initial and final. Yeah, so we have k equations. And the difference between this algorithm and the previous one is that we are going to use the singular value instead of the singular vector instead of the kernel, and it also allows us to have more than n measurements, and this is important because if you only have n minus one measurements, then the singular vector will be just be equal to the kernel, so there is no improvement. But by allowing k to be bigger than n minus one, we can hope that it will be more and more accurate as this k become large. Here is a theorem that we proved to that tells you the asymptotic behavior of the error. Okay, now let's denote as before. Let's denote n to be the number of unknown omegas, which is number also the same as number of local operators. And k is equal to the number of initial states, and we use lambda to denote the gap of the gap between the smallest singular value, which is just zero, and the second smallest singular value of this metric m over square root of k, and this lambda is a typical error on each measurement. Then the average error from the above procedure will be bounded by this form, and where theta is the angle between the reconstructed Hamiltonian and the true Hamiltonian. Recall that the Hamiltonian is represented as a vector, as an n by one vector. So yeah, we can calculate the angle, and if the angle is zero, there's just no error. So as you can see that as k goes to infinity, we have a one over square root of k. So it tells you that by doing more measurements, you can actually make the prediction like more accurate. And now the problem is that to understand this lambda, which is the gap between zero and the second smallest eigenvalue. Recall that we haven't said anything about how to choose your initial state. You can do it randomly or by some rules. And also I haven't tell you like how to choose your time interval between the initial and final. So these are just actually some parameters you can tune to make this lambda as large as possible so that this error is as small as possible. Okay, and so the first parameter is time. And here it results for this problem. Here, the x-axis is the time between the initial and final. And the y-axis is fidelity, which is just the cosine of that angle. As you can see, if t is zero, it will be pretty low. But after some time, it becomes pretty close to one. So like in this region, you have a pretty good reconstruction of those of the Hamiltonian. Like each point is average with like several hundreds of errors and Hamiltonians. Well, the answer of the first question that how to choose the time t is very simple. You just choose time t after this time. The reason for this is also very simple because this is because recall that the m that we constructed is the difference between the expression value of li in 0 and t. Right, so if t is zero, then if t is very small, then if m is very very small, so in this case the gap is very very small, so have no control of the error, and we want the gap to be big. That's why we want the time t to be like after some time. Okay, and for the second question, how to choose the initial state. So there are several possible choices. The first one is to choose a hard random state, like just random state. And in this case, I will not talk about the details, but in this case, using a very simple inequality, you will show that this gap is actually exponentially small, like goes like 1 over square root of d. So it's very bad, because the gap just appear in the denominator if it is exponentially small, which means that the error can be very big. So it's very bad. Okay. Here is the second choice. The second choice is to use random product state. And in this case, I will give you a claim without give you the proof that, okay, the claim is as follows. Assuming the eigenstate summarization hypothesis, ETH, as well as some approximation, which is can be verified by our numerics, then the singular value of this m over square root of k are distributed near 1 over 3 to the L over 2, where the L is the possible lenses of the Pauli operators that appear on the basis, and the gap will just be the minimum of them, which is 1 over 3 to the L max over 2. So here is an example. So here we calculate the eigenvalues of this metric, which is just the square of the singular values of m over k. And from this histogram, you can see very clearly that these are distributed over this last value and this value. And for this example, we use one body and two body Pauli operators in the basis. So this is the length is one or two. And this value is just 1 over 3, and 1 over 9, and 1 over 3. And this is the gap. So the result is that we have a pretty good understanding of the gap, which is just some constant that has no relation with, for example, with k, with n, or with the Hilbert size, with the Hilbert space dimension. It's just a constant. So it is pretty good. And the second type of stability is as follows. So in the real world, the Hamiltonian is not just the toy model. It always comes with some other like longer range terms, which I write mu i prime. For example, this can be some three body or four body terms, or some for example next to nearest neighbor interactions, but this mu I will be very small, and also it will normally decay with the support of Li. But we always want to use the first several terms to represent the true system. So we want to reconstruct this Hamiltonian in this form by our method, and that denotes the result to be omega prime, or the omega bar. And the question is, if this is a real system, but you construct the Hamiltonian in this form, then how far will the omega I be different from this omega? And so here is a theorem that is related to that kind of stability. So we denote the Hamiltonian as a vector, omega and nu. Then and also we denote the reconstructed Hamiltonian with our method as omega bar and zero. Then the angle between these two vectors the angle between this omega bar and omega will be bounded by this inequality. And so you can see that if this mu has a pretty small norm compared to this omega, then this sin theta is pretty under control. So in this sense that this algorithm is also very stable against the ignorance of this longer range interaction or many boring terms. Okay, now here's a summary. First of all, a generic many-body Hamiltonian can be uniquely determined from just a single pair of initial and final state. And by using multiple initial and final pairs, one will get a more practical method for the Hamiltonian tomography. And this method has a complexity O n squared, so which is very experimentally realizable. And also, this protocol is stable against errors, also very stable against the ignorance of longer range and many-body interactions. Well, I finished. Okay. Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, since there's a fair amount of time, could you go back to the method section again? And which one? The definitions of omega and L and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, here's the definition. So you fix a set of Li, which are local operators. For example, you can do with poly operators. And this omega I is the coupling constant in Hamiltonian. And this is omega I that you want to solve from the initial and final.
So the Li can be straight body term?
Yeah, it can be straight body term or Fourier term, but it should be fixed.
So later you mentioned long range, non-local terms.
Yeah.
Do you mean power law, has some power law tail?
For that result, you can assume, so it means that even if the system has some longer range interaction, as long as that interaction is very weak, in the sense that the coefficient is pretty small, so you can just ignore that and do this kind of reconstruction.
If I understand correctly, your scheme, it first, you specify what's the interactions, your Li.
Yeah.
The question is that what if there are some actual interactions that is not included in your assumption then?
Oh, you can do the second method with a pretty large range. It doesn't matter because it's just O n squared complexity. You can just do six body interactions and solve the huge problem. And you will see that it is just the case. And at the end, you can very confidently say that up to six body interactions, it just captures the Hamiltonian.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I missed something. So you said that when you talk about the stability against error, you said that you need at least a certain amount of time for the state to evolve, no?
Yes.
But surely there's something like this also needed, even if there are no errors, no? Because you could take a time that is basically arbitrarily small.
Mm-hmm.
And then
if there's just no error, then arbitrarily small is okay. Yeah. So you can see for arbitrary, so as long as there's no error, then in general this equation the equation for the second method here is just have a unique kernel.
Is there a sense in which this is harder to solve if the time is?
It's not hard to solve. It's always n minus 1 by n metric. So it's very easy to solve numerically. Yeah, but the only problem is that because the m itself is small, so if you just get m from error, then the answer will be unstable. That's why we need a single vector and something like that. And also that's why we need a long time so that this m become bigger.
See you again.
Okay, I think no questions, right? Okay, so thank you.